You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And top of the Monday to you, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Oh, a lot happened over the weekend. Mitt Romney won in Maine by, 194 votes, something like that. But there was one county where they shut down the Republican election, and the Ron Paul people are saying, you know, they didn't shut down the Girl Scout thing in that county because they thought there was going to be a snowstorm. So why'd they shut down the Republican election? This must be a conspiracy. Now, 4 years ago, Ron Paul only got 8 votes in that county, which wouldn't have caused him to win. But nonetheless, there's a Ron Paul conspiracy against, you know, about Mitt Romney. Rick Santorum. And then the other big Mitt Romney news over the weekend was that he won the CPAC straw poll. And Rick Santorum is pointing out that, well, you know, he bussed a lot of young people into CPAC to vote for him. And apparently he did. In fact, all of the young people at CPAC are bussed into CPAC, which is kind of one of CPAC's dirty little secrets, is that there's all, you know, all these different groups, most of them funded by billionaires, multimillionaires, or think tanks funded by billionaires and multimillionaires, who run scholarship programs and young college Republican groups and conservative groups around the country. You know, would you like a, 4-day all-expenses-paid trip to Washington, D.C., see the nation's capital, do a little lobbying, and get to go to CPAC and hang out with the hoi polloi, and you just have to be under 25 and attractive? Yeah, I mean, they've got their vetting processes. I've done CPAC every year for the last 5 years. I missed it this year because I have had the flu or bronchitis or whatever it was that I had. But, you know, it's amazing. You look around and it's like there's this sea of early 20-somethings and late teenagers who are all just, you know, bright and freshly scrubbed and wearing their Sunday best. And you think, wow, you know, Washington, D.C. must have a lot of young people in it and a lot of affluent, attractive-looking young people in it who are just gung-ho Republicans and conservatives. And, in fact, no, they're bussed in. And so apparently Mitt bussed a bunch of them in to make sure that he would win the straw poll, and he did. And Rick Santorum's all upset about that because he didn't have the money to do it or didn't think to do it, which brings up the question of this Mr. Freeze guy, Foster Freeze. We have a new billionaire in the crowd. Hey, if you've got a front runner, there must be a billionaire, on the Republican side, there must be a billionaire behind them. And sure enough, Rick Santorum is now the front runner nationally, 15 points ahead of Mitt Romney in the last national poll. And he's got this guy named Foster Freeze behind him. Adam Peck did some research on this over at the Center for American Progress. 7 facts you need to know about Foster Freeze. Number one, he has a long history funding Islamophobic organizations. Number two, he filmed an introductory video to Clarion Fund's Islamophobic Obsession documentary. Number three, he preached intolerance at a commencement speech at the School of Business at Pepperdine University. Number four, he has given a lot of money to Republican politicians. Number five, he donated to gay rights activist, or advocate rather, Senator Al D'Amato. That seems to be an anomaly. Number six, he was a founding donor to the Daily Caller. He put $3 million up, gave it to Tucker Carlson and his partner to get the Daily Caller going. And number seven, he claimed that liberals were to blame for the Columbine shooting in a speech at the Metropolitan Club in New York City in 2002. So, you know, who's meet the wackadoodle billionaires behind the front men, Republican front runners. Greg Palast is doing his very best to out the Wall Street billionaires behind Mitt Romney. And, John Paulson and, there's a shorter list, but it's a list of them, actually, on the Mitt Romney side. Most of the Wall Street billionaires, they have funded more, that collectively they have funded Mitt Romney more than all the other Republican candidates combined. and massively more than President Obama or any Democrats. And, of course, it was Shelley Adelson who was funding Newt Gingrich and, well, you can go through the list. Anyhow, the president, the other thing that's, so you know, this is kind of the, I guess that's the circus news for the day. So we can leave that behind and get into things that are a little more interesting. Greece was in flames over the weekend. And Greece was in flames because the banksters, Matt Taibbi did great research on this a couple of years back, wrote a piece for Rolling Stone. We had Matt on this program. He laid it all out, how Goldman Sachs and a couple of other New York banks basically helped Greece conceal the fact that they were so in debt at the time that they joined the EU that they didn't actually qualify to join the EU. And so Goldman Sachs got in the middle of it. They took on a lot of that debt, made it, you know, took it off the books of Greece, put it on their own books, and then charged Greece a huge fortune for it. And so Greece ended up even more in debt and holding a bunch of, you know, junk stuff that had been issued by New York banks that blew up in the big bank blow up of 2007, 2008, the Bush crash. And so anyhow, Greece is screwed. And so the banksters are saying, yeah, you may be screwed, but you're going to have to pay us back. Because that's what banksters do. And so the people are out in the streets. You know, Papandreou was their prime minister, and he had the audacity to say, well, hey, let's have a referendum. Let's have a vote like they did in Iceland and decide whether we should pay back the banksters. They got rid of him and replaced him with Papademos, the current guy who used to be the vice president of the central bank. Ah, put a bankster in charge. And the rest of the Greek parliament is just scared to death, and they're probably going to go along with this. Greece does have some serious structural problems, though. The biggest one is that their very rich people don't pay their taxes. Which brings us to the United States. The Congressional Budget Office, and in just a minute, I'm going to get to President Obama's budget, but which he's rolling out today. And the Republicans, of course, are not. They don't have a budget to roll out today. So what they will be doing is taking pot shots at Obama and basically saying, hey, wait a minute, we all swore loyalty to Grover Norquist that we would never raise taxes even one penny. And so they're just going to pick on it. But anyhow, let me get to that in just a second. The Congressional Budget Office last week looked at this question of whether we have the same problem Greece does of the billionaires and the big corporations not paying taxes. You know, most of the big money in Greece is made by the shipping magnates. And I met one of these guys. Well, long story. I negotiated with him on behalf of a German businessman back in the 80s. But it's a bizarre world. This was in Greece. And it's an absolutely bizarre world. But they incorporate offshore, they hide their money, they don't pay their taxes. So is the same thing happening in the United States? According to the Congressional Budget Office, yes. Corporations are showing more profits than they have in 40, 50 years, or at least they're back to their, if they're actually above their pre-bust levels. But corporate tax revenues coming into the federal government, 40-year low. Why is that? Well, things like what Mitt Romney did, you know, stashing their money in the Cayman Islands. The United States loses more than $90 billion a year, according to the Congressional Budget Office, from rich folks and big corporations using tax loopholes. And I would say it's probably even more than that, frankly. I think that's a very conservative number. The amount of money that we lose to tax dodging in the United States is more than we spend educating our entire next generation. More on that and the budget right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Just covering the best of the rest of the news here. And by the way, the fight for a free and open internet went international over the weekend. Riots in Europe on that. Okay, so the amount of money that we lose every year because of tax dodging by corporations, big corporate, you know, ExxonMobil last year. You and I paid for the military to defend the transportation of their oil from the Middle East here. They didn't pay a penny of that. You and I paid for the treatment of the tens of thousands of cancers in the United States caused by the use of the petroleum products that they refine. They didn't pay a penny of that. You and I paid for the hundreds of thousands of cases of asthma in the United States that ended up being picked up by, because most of this is in low-income areas. You look at Cancer Alley and Asthma Alley along the southern coast of the United States, downwind from the big refineries in Texas and Louisiana. And most of these people are being picked up by Medicare and Medicaid. You and me, we're paying the bill. ExxonMobil didn't pay a penny of that. How much did they pay in corporate income taxes last year? Nothing. The year before that, nothing. The year before that, nothing. How much did they make in profits? $30, $40 billion. And they're sitting around going, these Americans was suckers. Look at this. They're paying for the military to defend the oil getting over here. They're paying for the for all the externalities. What suckers these guys are in America. And it's not just them. General Electric paid nothing in income taxes last year. And yet they couldn't exist if it wasn't for an educated workforce that you and I paid for them, public education. They couldn't exist if it wasn't for a court system in which they can adjudicate contracts. Our court system is well over, you know, everybody thinks our court system is all about, you know, people being caught as criminals, right? No. Well over 60% of our total, the total use of our court system, which is paid for by you and me with our taxes, and should be by GE with its taxes, that over 60% of the total U.S. court system is corporations debating each other, contracting with each other, suing each other over business deals. Because you set up the rules of the game, and then you got to have the referees, and you got to have the adjudicators. Well, ExxonMobil, they want to use the court system, and they do heavily. But they don't want to pay for it. General Electric, they want to use it. They don't want to pay for it. And on the list goes. The total expenses of the Department of Homeland Security, which is huge. Been to an airport lately? I mean, that now includes, like, the FBI. It includes, I mean, it's just, it goes on and on. Okay, the total expense of the Department of Homeland Security nationally is less money than the amount that is lost to tax cheats. The total amount of the Department of Education, the total amount that we're spending nationwide in educating the next generation of our kids, our educational infrastructure, is less than the amount of money that we lose every year to tax cheats in this country. The total, and I realize, you know, Limbaugh with his $400 million contract, you know, goes, the rich are paying a lot in taxes, they're 47% of Americans aren't even paying federal income taxes. You've heard that? Well, first of all, this is one of the classic examples of how figures don't lie, but liars can figure. Before the Bush crash, it was 39% of Americans who didn't pay any federal income taxes. Why did it go from 39 to 47%? And why is it that they love quoting that 47%? Well, first of all, it makes it sound like half the nation's freeloaders. Not the case. Secondly, the reason why it was 39% to begin with is because about 35% of this country lives at or below the poverty level. If the minimum wage today in inflation-adjusted dollars was where it was in 1965, it would be over $10. It's not. So you've got people out there who are living on $10, $12, $15, $20,000 a year, and you know, you got a family and a couple of kids. I dare you to. Right? You get these right-wing fools who are, you know, hey, I got mine. Screw them. They should be paying some taxes. Well, they are. They're paying FICA taxes. They're paying sales taxes. They're paying fees. They're paying property taxes. And if they don't own a home and they're renting, they're paying property taxes hidden in that. They're paying taxes on pretty much everything. In fact, it's been about a year. I don't have the numbers right in front of me right now, but the Center for American Progress did a really interesting study. Those people who don't pay any federal income taxes, compare them with the average person in the United States who makes over $1 million a year, and the percentage of their income that they actually do pay taxes on is higher for the poor people. even though it's not income taxes. You know, the cost of just getting a driver's license, that tax, if you call fees taxes, I think you legitimately can. It's a greater percentage of the income of somebody who makes $10,000 a year than it is somebody who makes $1 million a year. So, anyhow, Tom Friedman writes, you know, we need a second party. The Republican Party has gone nuts. I would say, and you know, he says, you know, when they won't take a deal that's $1 in tax increases for $10 in spending cuts, then they've officially gone insane. And I think he's right. He's behaving like it doesn't happen. It hasn't happened before. I'd say it certainly has happened before. You know, in the early 1900s, the Republican Party was a progressive party under Teddy Roosevelt. Then it got, you know, went crazy in 1920. Warren Harding, the right-wing radicals took it over. Harding came in as president in 21, dropped the top tax rate from 91% down to 25%, set off the roaring 20s, the bubble, a land bubble and a stock bubble. That the land bubble popped in 1927, the stock bubble popped in 29, gave us the Great Depression. The moderates took over the Republican Party back again in 34, and the radicals took it again in 46, took control of the House and Senate for 2 years. That was it. Blew things up so badly, they lost the House for the next 26 years. And the moderates came in 52 with Eisenhower. And I'll continue the cycle after this, but the point is, I think we're at the edge of another cycle.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And, you know, a few diehard Limbaugh listeners notwithstanding, or Fox viewers notwithstanding, I think by and large the Republican Party is about to go through a real radical change.
It's just time to pay the price for not listening to advice and deciding in your youth on the policy.
34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 866-987-THOM. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com. Drop into our live chat room. Make your own blog. Participate in our message boards. Just click the community link. There's lots and lots of cool stuff there. The Republican Party. Let me just wrap this up and then we'll get to you, right to your calls here in just a second. It seems to me that every generation, there's like a generation on, generation off cycle. In every other generation, the Republican Party basically goes insane. And I was up to just a minute ago, and in just a moment here, Paul, I'm going to be calling for clip number 8 and clip number 7. I was going through the cycles, and I said, okay, and in 52, the moderates took over the Republican Party with the Eisenhower presidency. And then in 64, the right-wingers took it over with the Goldwater candidacy, the fringe, the hard-right fringe. And then that kind of crashed and burned, and so in 72, I guess it was, you had the moderates took back the Republican Party with Richard Nixon, who, yes, was a moderate. Richard Nixon proposed a national health care system virtually identical to Obamacare in 73. Go back and look it up. It'll blow your mind. And so anyhow, the moderates took it back in the 70s, and then in the 1980s, of course, Reagan came along, and the crazies, the right-wingers, took the Republican Party again, and you had we had the worst recession during the Reagan administration that we had had since the Great Depression. It followed his giant tax cut on millionaires and billionaires. Unemployment was over 12%. There was the biggest stock market crash since the Great Depression during the Reagan administration. We tend to forget all these things, right? Reagan's policies didn't work all that well. Reagan ran up more debt in 8 years. And to get out of the disaster that he created with his tax cuts and his fiscal policies, what he did was he raised taxes radically on working people. He doubled the taxes. The biggest tax increase on working people, on people who make under $100,000 a year in the history of the United States, happened in the Reagan administration. Just like, oddly enough, and nobody seems to know about it, the biggest tax cut in the history of the United States on people making under $100,000 a year happened during the Obama administration. But in any case, so Reagan raises taxes on working people, and but it still wasn't enough. He still borrowed more money than every president from George Washington through Abraham Lincoln, through Teddy Roosevelt, through Franklin, all the way up to Jimmy Carter. You take all of them combined, Ronald Reagan borrowed more money in 8 years than every president of the United States up until that point combined. And he left office in 1988, leaving us with a near $3 trillion debt. When he came into office, we had never had even a $1 trillion debt. And then the moderates took over the Republican Party again with George Herbert Walker Bush, who had called Reaganomics voodoo economics. He raised taxes, which lost him the election. The crazies were still had some force, but you know, the moderates took over the Republican Party. And then the crazies took it back again with the election of George W. Bush, and you know, and they got a little boost with the Tea Party thing in 2010. And I predict that the moderates are about to take the Republican Party back. Now, it's going to take one of two forms. Either it's going to be a big electoral bashing, and basically you're just going to see the crazies get kicked out. Or it's going to be the presidency of Mitt Romney, who's going to take off his mask and show us that he's actually the same Republican he was when he was the Republican governor of Massachusetts, a moderate, a Richard Nixon Republican. But, you know, we will see. But as a result of these cycles, this country has suffered tremendously. I mean, the damage that was done during the Reagan administration, the damage that's been done to working people in the 30 years of Reaganomics that we've had since then. We basically no longer have a strong middle class. The vast majority of the American middle class now has so little equity in their homes and in their savings that if they lose their job, if they lose all their forms of income within a year at the most, well over 50% of all Americans within 3 months are wiped out. But the vast majority, you know, more than 80% are wiped out within a year. People got nothing. And then you go back to how it happened last time. You know, when the crash happened in 1929, you had Herbert Hoover. He was president. He was the third right-wing president in a row. It started out with Harding in 1920 and then Coolidge in 24? 28? No, it must have been 24. And then Hoover was elected in 28. And the crash happened in 29. And Hoover's response to it was to have austerity, right? Let's tighten the screws down a little bit. We got to cut taxes on the rich people, keep them low. You know, the recession's not a time to raise taxes. FDR came in, by the way, and raised taxes on rich people up to 91%, where they stayed from the 1940s or late 1930s all the way up until the 1960s. And what did it do? It produced a revolution in America. Rich people got rich, but the middle class got richer. So anyhow, we had these Hoovervilles. And this is an extraordinary piece. This is Joe Hameler. And while it's playing, I'm going to try and find the credit for this. A fellow sent me this over the last week, and I want to acknowledge him online, and I don't have that credit line here in front of me. But this is from a piece that the Democratic National Committee played, I believe it was the day before the election of 1944. Franklin Roosevelt running against Thomas Dewey. And this is Joe Hameler. He was one of the first Occupy guys occupying Anacostia here in Washington, D.C. They were from the Potomac River up to the White House. They occupied it. And Herbert Hoover sent the military in, and here's what this guy had to say.
I'm French O'Tone.
I'm Frank Sinatra.
I'm nobody. Nobody's heard of me. Joe Hameler is my name. I fought in the last war. I served in the Navy. I'm another kind of a veteran, too. I'm a veteran of Anacostia Flats. That's the place in Washington where us bonus marchers built a town out of crates and tin cans. That's the place where a Republican president ordered an attack on us veterans and our families and drove us out with guns and gas. On July 28, 1932, I saw two of my buddies get killed in that attack. I was there. I saw them killed. Now, here is why I am voting for Roosevelt. He gave us vets a square deal and a new deal. Roosevelt will see that the kids in this war will get a break, too. Roosevelt has been for all the people, all the time. With Roosevelt, we will get a plan to give jobs to everyone. When somebody says to you, we had a New Deal depression, you ask him, what was the name of those shanty towns all over the country, like the ones we built down at Anacostia?
You can bring
ask
it back.
Ask him, was it Rooseveltville or Hooverville?
There you go. And so, you know, this is this guy. I saw two of my friends killed. This was when the government came in and busted up these Occupy things. And what was the name?
Paul Collins
is the guy who sent this to me. Thank you, Paul, for that. Randy in West Ailis, Wisconsin. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Hey, good morning. You know, I've actually never seen your show before until this morning, and I just realized you're the guy who wrote that book, Screwed, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. I'm going to have to go out and get that book. Hey, I just got a real quick question, and this might actually seem a little stupid. I know George Romney ran for president, and I from what I understand recently, what I've seen on television, he's apparently immigrated here from Mexico. If he was not born in the United States, how could he have run for the presidency?
I don't know. I don't know. You know, people have asked me that question before, and I keep saying I'm going to look it up one of these days, and I'm going to have to because people keep asking. But I genuinely don't know the answer. His father and grandfather went down to Mexico because polygamy was made illegal in the United States, and they had a bunch of wives. And you know, whether they came across the border to give birth to George and then went back or what, I don't, you know, I frankly don't know, Randy. I'm sorry. You know, but life in the big city. Israel in Rochester, New York. Hey, Israel, what's up?
How you doing this afternoon? I usually watch it, but, you know, never really called until this time now, and I appreciate you taking my call. And I would want to address to let the American people know that it's not really about Democrat, Republican, because both of them ideally is the problem. Because once people start to look at the Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, you will see there's Democrats and Republicans in this, what they call the membership.
Yeah, there are, you know, the international banking conspiracy. We do have a problem with international banksters, but they're not the only billionaires out there. And the guys on Wall Street are not, you know, the people who are funding these, you know, Foster Freeze and Shelley Adelson and John Paulson, these hedge fund billionaires. These are not the Bilderbergs. It's not part of the giant banker conspiracy, or if you want to use the Stormfront language, the giant Jewish conspiracy, or any of that kind of nonsense. But there are some very wealthy people who are looking out for their own interests. And right now, because of Citizens United, Supreme Court decision, they're able to buy politicians in the United States, and they are doing so. But you know, that's not necessarily a good thing. In fact, it's arguably a very bad thing. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your calls right after this, 45 minutes past the hour. Is the Republican Party going to cycle back into a rational phase?
Let the good times roll.
Yeah, was that Grover Norquist on the screen? Good grief. So this is welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And this is, let me just a little bit of Ronald Reagan for you, and then I'm going to pick up your calls. This is what Reagan said back in the 1980s. There was this in 1986 for one year in the history of the 20th century. For one year, the income tax rate paid by capitalists on capital gains, the way that Mitt Romney makes his living, the way that Warren Buffett makes his living, that rate was identical, 28%, with the top income tax rate made by, you know, ordinary income, made by CEOs, made by, you know, whatever, by rock stars, fill in the blanks. It was identical, and Ronald Reagan wanted it that way. He wanted them to be the same. Here's what he had to say about it.
We're going to close the unproductive tax loopholes that have allowed some of the truly wealthy to avoid paying their fair share. They sometimes made it possible for millionaires to pay nothing, while a bus driver was paying 10% of his salary, and that's crazy.
And that's crazy. But don't tell that to Rush Limbaugh. It'll make his head explode. I mean, it'll just genuinely make his head explode. So, Stephen in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Stephen, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Congratulations on beating the creeping crud.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's still hanging on in a little form, but I'm knocking it out. What's up?
Okay. Just wanted to know where are we headed in regards to the taxation of the high-speed financial transactions tax?
It is going so far nowhere. There has been an attempt. The Progressive Caucus in Congress has been pushing this thing. They have not been able to get any traction at all in the House of Representatives, which is controlled by the Tea Party and the Republican Party. And yeah, so nothing's going to happen. The main place where it is getting traction is France. Nicolas Sarkozy, who is, you know, a conservative on the order of George W. Bush and was good friends with, is pushing this thing really, really hard in France right now, a 0.1% tax on every financial transaction. And that would discourage high-frequency trading, which is putting our system so at risk and making hundreds of millions and tens of billions of dollars for a small group, a few hundred people on Wall Street. And Sarkozy thinks this is wrong. He's pushing it in France. You were going to say.
It's crazy. I sat here and saw on CNBC the day, May of 2010, when the Dow lost 900,000 points in the matter of minutes.
Yeah, the flash crash.
It's crazy, and the bubbles that are created are insane. You know, I spent a little bit of time in the financial services industry as well. You know, I was in manufacturing for about 15 years, healthcare for 15 years, you know, paying claims, and also a little bit in the financial services industry. And I'll tell you one thing, we need tight regulations. So, you know, investors that still have money in the market.
Yeah, it's like imagine a football game.
And bring this country to its knees.
No, you're absolutely right. Imagine a football game with no rules and no referees. That's how the banking industry wants us to handle it. And the biggest danger that can come out of a football game is that a team loses, right? I mean, you know, maybe the bettors are the ones who are going to lose the most. But with the banking industry, you're talking about playing a game where the entire country can be sucked down. So excellent point, Stephen. Thank you for calling and making it. Well said. Shirley in Garland, Texas. Hey, Shirley, what's up?
Hey there. I want to know about the FICO scores on all these people that are running for office or even the ones that are in office. I believe in the old adage that figures never lie, but liars sometimes figure.
Yeah, yeah, sometimes and frequently. That's a good question. I have no idea what the FICO scores are of members of Congress, but, you know, we could. I'm guessing if your member of Congress is running, show up at a town hall meeting and just pop your hand up and say, hey, what's your FICO score? And turn it into an issue. It's like, you know, they're all out there yelling, let me see your tax returns. So excellent point, Shirley. Thank you. Joel in New York City. Hey, Joel, what's up?
Hi. The Battle of Anacostia Flats that you opened with was not so much Hoover as Douglas MacArthur saying that it was real important to make it as violent as possible to impress demonstrators that they shouldn't go against the government. And FDR and the Democratic Party said, by gosh, MacArthur just gave us the election for sure.
Yeah, and he did. He did. And that was the first Occupy movement. They had occupied Anacostia. And if I'm mispronouncing that, my apologies, Anacostia. And you're right. MacArthur went in there, and he actually had Eisenhower at his side. And
that's why FDR viewed as two major dangers to him from the left and the right within the was MacArthur from the right and Joseph Kennedy from the left. That's how come part of the reason Joseph Kennedy ended up in England was not just so that FDR could reward him by making him the ambassador to England, but also so that he could get him the hell out of the United States. And you couldn't put MacArthur further away from the United States than being in charge of the Philippines.
Yeah. excellent point. And then Harry Truman came along and fired him, you know, because he was such a curmudgeon.
For the same reason that Hoover could have fired him with the Anacostia Flats.
And, yeah.
Right, and Hoover thought about doing that.
And should have. Joel, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for sharing that with us. Harvey in Branson, Missouri. You got the last minute of this hour. Harvey, what's up?
Well, hi, Tom. I've just recently got dialed into your show, and I like it. You're the only one on media that tells the truth.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. But I'm calling about Mr. Romney and how many other millionaires and billionaires in the world are not paying their taxes. He's got these offshore accounts. He pays a minimal amount of tax.
About 15%.
And that's nothing to him. I mean, but how much is he not paying offshore? I mean, that guy that called in a little earlier about he was the stay-at-home dad, and there's millions of people like him that Fox News has brainwashed into this thinking that they've got, and they just don't get it. I mean, I live in Branson, around Branson, and this is the right-wing capital of the world. You would not believe how ignorant these people are of those facts.
Yeah.
And I appreciate you talking about that.
Well, thank you for the call and the acknowledgement, Harvey. I appreciate it. And, you know, we just need to keep talking about it. And I think that it's going to be a very, very interesting election campaign if we don't have a brokered convention, which I want to talk about in the next hour, whether the Republicans are going to have a brokered convention or not. If we don't, and Mitt Romney is the nominee, or even if we do and he is the nominee, it's going to be fascinating. But Santorum's leading Romney in Michigan right now.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So could there be a brokered Republican convention? Greg Palast has this interesting conspiracy theory that he was circulating in email. You can read it, I'm sure, over at gregpalast.com, that the guys, Paul Singer is one of the guys that he likes to he has outed quite thoroughly in his new book. And Greg Palast has, one of the Wall Street hedge fund fat cats who's funding the Romney campaign or other campaigns. But, they're looking at Romney and going, yeah, he's a rich guy. He's going to work on our behalf, but maybe he just can't win. Maybe he's not the guy who's, we need not just a rich guy who's going to defend our interests, but a rich guy who's going to defend our interests who can actually beat Obama. I mean, keep in mind, having the perfect candidate is marvelous, except if he's not actually a perfect candidate in the electoral sense. And increasingly, I mean, here, this new poll, this over TPM right now, this is the headline, Santorum leads Romney in Michigan. Two new polls show former, this is Kyle Layton writing for Talking Points Memo. Two new polls show former Senator Rick Santorum with real strength ahead of Michigan's February 28th Republican primary. And that is, what is today's date? The 13th? Yeah, so that's what, a couple of weeks down the road here. Now, a lot can happen in a couple of weeks. I mean, a lot has happened in the last week. Rick Santorum went from being unknown in Michigan to being to holding a good chunk of the lead. He's at 36% versus Mitt Romney at 29%. Why is Michigan so important? Well, first of all, Michigan has become a right-wing wackadoodle state. You've got a right-wing wackadoodle governor, Rick Snyder. You've got a right-wing wackadoodle Senate and a right-wing wackadoodle House that passed a law that said that any right-wing wackadoodle governor can fire people who have been elected by the people of the state of Michigan to run a city or to be a school board, to run a school or anything else. Don't like the way they're running it. If they're not fiscally sound, fire them and replace them with an emperor, a czar. Something a little odd with all this, but in any case, that's the Michigan that I grew up in. I spent the first 27 years of my life in, and was born in. And when I was a young'un, our governor was George Romney. And Mitt's dad. And Mitt, I believe, was born in Michigan. Pretty sure. I mean, we didn't hear any talk about Mitt when I was a little kid, but if he wasn't born in Michigan, he certainly grew up there with his dad as the governor. And so Michigan should be like hometown territory, right up there with Massachusetts, although Mitt spends so much time running around the country trashing Massachusetts, and I didn't inhale, in fact, the latest one, this is truly amazing. in the Jed report from the Daily Kos staff, Jed Lewison's writing over at the Daily Kos, he points out two great quotes in a current New York Times write-up about Mitt Romney being pro-choice, anti-choice, or whatever you want to call it, pro-life, anti-life, pro-choice, pro-life. And he says, back in 1994, when Mitt Romney was running for governor of Massachusetts and whatnot, he was pro-choice. He was in favor of the right of women to choose to have an abortion. And in 2005, well, here, I'll just read the sentence. By 2005, with Mr. Romney eyeing a possible presidential bid, he began to distance himself from his abortion rights platform. My political philosophy is pro-life, he told National Review, a conservative magazine, in an article that June. That same article quoted his top strategist at the time, Mike Murphy, who you've probably all seen on TV at various times, as saying Mr. Romney had, quote, been a pro-life Mormon, faking it as a pro-choice friendly. End quote. End of quote. Isn't that another way of saying he was lying? And Louise tells me Mitt Romney was actually born in Detroit, Michigan, so this is his home state. So it's not that he just changed his policy, but that he, during all that time that he was running for governor of Massachusetts and he was governor of Massachusetts and everything, that he was lying to the people about his position. Now, lying about your position is a different thing than saying, you know, my position is that I'm pro-life, you know, if I was Mitt Romney. And I recognize that the majority of the voters in this state are pro-choice, and so I'm not going to do anything to mess with the laws that allow Massachusetts to be a more pro-choice-friendly state, because that's what the voters want. I mean, there's no shortage of members of Congress who have stood up on numerous occasions. This is not at all uncommon in this town to say, I personally don't like this position, but this is the position that my constituents sent me here to defend. This is what's best for my district. I mean, they typically don't say it quite that bluntly, but you know, you can read through it. But Romney apparently was just lying. And you combine that with the thing, you know, why does he have these tax accounts in the Caymans? Well, they're in his 401k apparently, and there's this. And again, TPM has been on this, really doing a great job. Apparently, if you take your 401k money and you use that money to increase that money, in other words, you got a, you know, in the case of Mitt Romney, he's probably got $100 million in his 401k, whatever it is. You got a bunch of money in your 401k, and you say, I'm going to use leverage. I'm going to leverage this money and make bets in the marketplace to make more money with this money. Not just, you know, buy a slow investment that returns 3% a year, but I'm going to make 80% a year on this thing, or 300% a year. If you do that inside the United States, that income, even though it's in your 401k, gets taxed at 35%. However, if you do that in a country, if you move the money from your 401k into a country where they don't have a personal income tax, like the Cayman Islands, and then you do this little leverage trick and you make your 401k a lot richer, and so you go from being only worth $100 million to being worth $200 or $300 million, and a lot of it's in your retirement funds, you don't pay a tax on it. There's a fancy name for the tax. So anyhow, the billionaires who are behind these guys, Shelley Adelson, who was behind the billionaire behind Newt Gingrich, and now we've got this new billionaire who is behind Rick Santorum. He's got to be very happy with himself. Foster Freeze, or Friess, F-R-I-E-S-S. Maybe it's Foster Friess. In any case. And, you know, Paul Singer and John Paulson, the billionaires who are behind all these guys, they're basically looking out for their billions. They're looking out for their interests. And you know, candidate A, candidate B, candidate C, it doesn't matter. They just want somebody who can beat Obama because Obama's talking about raising their taxes. So Greg Palast's conspiracy theory, which is where I started this whole thing, is that there's going to be a brokered convention, that they're going to keep pumping people up as the primaries go along so that Romney never gets that threshold, you know, a little over 1,000 delegates that he needs for the convention. And so he's going to go into a convention that's going to be brokered. And then in the smoke-filled back rooms, the billionaires will be able to pick out who they're going to put forward. It might not even be anybody who ran. It might be Chris Christie or John Kasich or somebody like that. Interesting.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And in the meantime, the president has laid out his budget and said, you know, let's move this country forward. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I just find this all quite amazing. The president has come out with his budget, or is coming out with his budget, $3.8 trillion for next year. It is dead on arrival in the House of Representatives because it raises taxes by more than $1. Not exaggerating, not making that up. It raises taxes by more than $1. Because all these guys have signed an oath of loyalty, not to you, not to me, not to the Constitution, not to the voters, not to the states that they came from and are here to represent, but to a multimillionaire lobbyist here in Washington, D.C. I saw him by the name of Grover Norquist. I saw him most recently at a I don't know if you want to call it a cocktail party. It was an event here in town. Back about 3 months ago, went over and said hi, shook his hand. He used to be, you know, he comes on our program from time to time. It's been about a year. And he was telling me the story of going quail hunting down in Texas with some fat cat Republican. But here's what Grover most recently had to say.
Our friends on the left begin to look at each other around the table a little bit more like the second to the last scene in those lifeboat movies. Now they're wondering who they're going to eat or who they're going to throw overboard. The left is not made up of friends and allies. It is made up of competing parasites.
So that is Grover Norquist, who's, you know, funded by billionaires like the Koch brothers. That is how a multimillionaire lobbyist funded by billionaires views the average American voter, over 70% of whom want a strong and stable Social Security, in fact, want it improved, strengthened. You know, 3/4 of whom think that we should have a national health care system. The vast majority of whom, of American voters, who think that we need a strong social safety net so that if people are out of work, that the government can be the employer of last resort or provide long-term unemployment benefits. And on it goes. That those are all parasitical things. But being a billionaire and paying a maximum and having your own special tax rate, what Ronald Reagan referred to as a tax loophole, That's not being a parasite. You got that? You still got that Reagan clip? Here it is again. This is Ronald Reagan referring to the capital gains tax.
We're going to close the unproductive tax loopholes that have allowed some of the truly wealthy to avoid paying their fair share. They sometimes made it possible for millionaires to pay nothing while a bus driver was paying 10% of his salary, and that's crazy.
Right, that's crazy. But if you say, you know, why doesn't that billionaire pay the same amount of tax as his secretary? That makes you a parasite. At least if you're speaking on behalf of the multimillionaires like Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and Roger Ailes and billionaires like Rupert Murdoch, multimillionaires like Glenn Beck. At least if you're speaking on behalf of them and their interests, then, you know, geez, anybody who wants to say, shouldn't they pay the same tax rate as everybody else? That's a parasite. Here's clip number one, Mitt Romney at CPAC. What I find most fascinating about this is that in the prepared remarks that Romney released as he was about to get up on the lectern and speak, in other words, in his speech, in what he was reading off the teleprompter, there was no modifying adjective. The word severely did not exist in that speech. He ad-libbed it. Listen to him ad-lib this thing.
My state was a leading indicator of what liberals would be trying to do across the country and are trying to do right now. And I fought against law and odds in a deep blue state. But I was a severely conservative Republican governor.
Severely conservative. Let's see, Massachusetts, number one in education in America. Number one in marriages staying intact in America, number one in longevity in America, number one in the, you know, the fetal survival in America. Most quality of life indexes are in the top five anyway in Massachusetts. Well, of course, that's a liberal state. So the president says, well, let's make the rest of the country a little more liberal. Let's build our roads. Let's have a good highway system like they've got in Massachusetts. And let's do it by taxing the millionaires like they do in Taxachusetts. Not taxing them to the point that they're paupers or that they're going to say, oh, I don't want to go to work anymore. Although, I mean, how much do you have to earn to go to work? I love reading Rex Stout novels. The Nero Wolfe novels by Rex Stout. And most of them were written in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, when the top tax rate was in the 90% range. And so often, you know, Stouty is a private detective and he gets these huge fees and somebody comes knocking on the door and Archie answers the door and basically says, you know, the detective, Nero Wolfe, doesn't want to take on your case because, you know, he's already in the top tax bracket, and he'll only keep 8 cents or 9 cents on the dollar that you pay him. And then he gets intrigued by the case, and he takes it on anyway, right? Because if you love your work, after you've made your first million, well, if you don't make so much on the second million, it's still work you love. And if you don't love your work, then, hey, make the first million, take it, and stop. Make room for somebody else. Am I talking like a parasite here? I think so. I'll have to have a conversation with Grover about that. Maybe he can straighten me out. They're trying to do it in this austerity thing in Greece, by the way. Fascinating results. I'll tell you about that. We'll pick up your calls right after this. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And why is Rick Santorum leading Romney? Is it because of Foster Price? So President Obama wants to cut the budget deficit by $4 trillion over the next decade by raising taxes on corporations, profitable corporations, who right now aren't paying any taxes, and very wealthy people who are paying lower taxes than, as Ronald Reagan said, bus drivers. And it's just, and he wants to cut the defense budget by 5% over the next decade. Now, this is a defense budget that has gone up 200% since 1997, so cutting it by 5% seems pretty modest to me. So anyhow, we'll see where all this goes, and we'll see where this whole thing is going. Jim Cramer, though, is having this Morning Joe conversation. This is over at Mediaite, and he was talking to Joe Scarborough, and Scarborough says, business leaders I find really like Mitt Romney a lot. And Jim Cramer, you know, the CNBC mad money crazy guy, right-wing wackadoodle, he says, but I got to tell you, no one sounds as enthusiastic as I thought they'd be, and people are starting to look to, people are starting to talk about Obama. Yeah, there was a poll last week, came out on Friday, 20% of Republicans right now say they may well vote for Obama. That's got to be scary news for the Republican Party. So, anyhow, where's it all going? Who knows? Don in Tampa, Florida. Hey, Don, what's on your mind? Don?
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I think the question was asked a few minutes ago about Santorum leading Romney in Michigan.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's because of the car industry. I mean, Romney was willing to let the GM fail and Chrysler fail. And,
that's an
and I think
point.
The Michigan voters are very resentful of that.
Yeah.
And it's anybody but Romney.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I think you probably just put your finger on it, Don. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. And well said. Joe in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Joe, thanks for listening to 1350. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I was wondering, I keep hearing this phrase called Keynesian economics.
Yes, sir.
I don't understand it. What does that mean?
John Maynard Keynes is a guy who wrote a book, the title of which was something like The General Theory of Economics, back in the 1930s, as I recall. And he was one of the great economic thinkers of the early 20th century. And he suggested, and Franklin Roosevelt took his advice, that the way that you get a country out of a business cycle depression, and in fact, there's some new thinking now about what even caused the Great Depression, that because the agricultural revolution was really picking up steam in the 1910s, 1920s, they were, you know, the internal combustion engine was going big time. They were starting to seriously use tractors instead of mules on farms, and the national rail system was getting very effective, and cars and trucks were starting to move things on our roads instead of horse-drawn carriages as they were just 30 years earlier. That the productivity of our farms, and a quarter of the entire workforce of the United States was on the farm in 1920. What had happened was that the farming became so productive that there was a surplus of food and the price crashed. And when the price of food crashed, the farmers went broke, which was a quarter of the American economy. When the farmers went broke, they didn't have enough money to buy goods and services from the local stores. And so the demand for goods and services dried up, and so the factories started laying off people, and those people got laid off, and they didn't have money to buy things, and so there was a further drop in demand, and you had this downward spiral that was feeding itself. And Keynes identified that spiral. He didn't identify the specific agricultural component of it, but he identified that spiral and said, the way you have to break out of this is to create an upward spiral. And the only way that you can do that is by injecting money into the economy. And the entry point for that money that will have the greatest effect is the pocket of the working person or the unemployed person. And in fact, one of the examples that Keynes used, and the reason why is because when working people make $100, they spend $100. Whereas when Joe Kennedy made $100, that was $100 he put in a Swiss bank account. And so if you want to get the money circulating through the economy, you want to get it in the pockets of working people. That was John Maynard Keynes's main contribution. And in fact, Keynes said the government should be the employer of last resort. And that he said, this is such a fundamental principle. I'm paraphrasing here, but this is such a fundamental principle that you could hire one person to dig a hole and hire another person to fill it. And it would help rebuild the economy. Now, why would that happen? Well, if the government is hiring these people and it's using even borrowed money to do it, suddenly you take two people who were generating no tax revenue and generating nothing for the economy, and now they have money in their pockets. They're paying taxes on that income. They take that money to the local store and they buy food, they buy clothes, they buy toys for their kids for Christmas or for birthdays or just for their kids. They improve their home and all of those things. Then when they buy a toy at the local toy store, then the toy manufacturer has to build more toys. And so if they have to build more toys, they have to hire somebody. And so they go to the guy who's digging the hole and they say, hey, you're just digging holes for the government. Why don't you come to work for our toy factory? We'll pay you more and it's a better job. And pretty soon you don't need the guy digging the hole anymore. That was Keynes's theory, and Franklin Roosevelt put it into practice. And it worked really well. It got us out of the Great Depression. You saw a 15% increase or decrease in the unemployment rate in the first year in 1934. by 1934. The stock market had its biggest jump in its history in the next year, 1934. And by 1936, Americans were feeling like we were pretty much out of the Great Depression. And so in the election of 36, of course, the Republicans were hysterical about this. They hated Keynes, and they were fond of Milton Friedman and the Austrian school, which is the Ron Paul theology, the IMF and Greece theology of, you know, government shouldn't do any of these things. Government should never hire a guy to dig a hole. That's stupid. And so FDR said in 1936, he said, okay, now let's try to balance the budget. We borrowed a lot of money to get out of the Depression. Let's try and pay some of it back. And so in 37, he dialed back these programs, but we weren't out of the Depression yet. And so what happened was we had a second mini Depression in 37, which hurt us very badly. And then, of course, by, you know, 3 years later, so he came back in 38, started spending money again. We started climbing out of the hole. And then, of course, we went into World War II. And World War II was the ultimate proof that Keynes was right. Because in World War II, we didn't just double government spending. We increased it like fivefold or tenfold. It was a massive increase in government spending. And it completely got us out of the Great Depression and set the stage for 50 years of prosperity. Until Ronald Reagan came along and said, hey, supply-side economics, forget about what the average working man is making. It's what the billionaires make that matters. In other words, he flipped things back upside down on their head like in 1920 Warren Harding had when he dropped the top, when he became president, the first Republican president to embrace these crazy policies and the whole Austrian school, Milton Friedman, Chicago school thing, and dropped that top tax rate and set off the bubble of the 20s that led to the crash of the Great Depression. Have I done a good job, Joe, of giving you Milton Friedman in a can?
Yeah, right on. Thank
okay.
you very much.
Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. That's Milton Friedman 101, I guess. Or not Milton Friedman. I'm sorry. John Maynard Keynes 101. Joe, listening to WHMP in Hatfield, Massachusetts. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, Tom, can you hear me okay?
It sounds like you're on a speakerphone, Joe. If you'd pick it up, I'd appreciate it.
You know, I'm on Skype. I don't know.
Oh, okay. Well, it's the best you can do then. Just let's just finish the call here. What's up?
Okay. Yeah, first off, I think I've got to get more insurance. I listen to you almost every day, and I need more insurance because my head explodes every day.
Excuse me. But, don't make me laugh.
Yeah, I'm now in the later years. I'm in my early 60s, and the only job I can get is part time at $10 an hour. But I'm an inventor, and so I've got a product, a widget, let's call it. It's really good, and I know in order to sell it, I got to go get a lawyer and spend a lot of money getting, you know, not a copyright, but
trademark.
A design.
Patent. Yeah, a basic patent these days costs anywhere from $10,000 to $30,000.
Yeah, I'm scared of that. But
yeah.
My question is, because I know I've got to have a business plan, here's the question. I've thought about this for years. Somebody makes a successful product, and it sells, and they make money. Why in our system do we have to have a plan that says every year you're going to make 20% more? Because it just seems like greed takes over if you're successful. And you can't just, why can't you just survive on the good money that you're making?
Well, some people do. And if you look at the history of America, and if you're in your 60s, you're old enough to remember this, that when you were a kid, where are you located? You're in Hatfield, Mass. If you were living in that town or wherever you were living as a kid, the downtown, most of those businesses were family owned businesses that had been in the family for generations. Am I right?
Right.
They're not anymore, are they?
No, they're not even there.
Yeah, or if they are there, they're big chain stores that are owned by big transnational corporations. They're the same brands and the same companies. You know, it's the same Taco Bell and the same TGI Fridays and the same Hooters and the same, you know, Macy's and whatever that you see all over the place. And so the reason why that demand for continual profit is there is because people like you end up having to go to people with money to get their invention out there, and then those people with money start monetizing the business, and you know, they just want to make more money. They're not interested in building the business. Joe, I'd give you a more detailed explanation, but I'm hitting the break here. Thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Joe, I wish you well, by the way, in getting your invention out there. Also, what you're illustrating is the difference between venture capital and vulture capital, which I'll explain right after this.
Some things will never change. They stand there looking backwards, ever conscious from the pain.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Joe in Long Beach listening on K-Talk. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Oh, hey, Tom. How's it going?
Great.
It seems that Mitt Romney is always hiding behind his boring trust. And I'd like you to kind of educate us more about that. I mean, I kind of feel that for him being a multimillionaire, I find it hard to believe that he doesn't get some kind of accounting of where all his money is being invested.
You know, I genuinely don't know. There are blind trusts and there are blind trusts. There are some blind trusts that are required by law. I genuinely don't know how Mitt Romney has put his together. He's not in a situation where he is required by law to have blind trusts. And
right.
So probably he's actively investing or managing some of his money, or he's at least close to the people who are. Much of it may well be in a genuinely blind trust, but, you know, you get somebody who's really smart and they're going to do it well, but because there are so many ways that you can, you know, here's what makes me think that maybe Mitt Romney actually did put his money in a blind trust. And that is that there was so much of it stashed in the Swiss banks and the Caymans. And you can churn 401k money in low profit domiciles like that and not have to pay a 35% income tax on the outrageous rapid profits. Whereas if you try the same little churn trick with inside a 401k here in the United States, you get hit with a maximum tax rate, even though it's inside the 401k. And, frankly, if he, running for president, he may not have wanted to have done that. On the other hand, it might have been done, you know, set up 10 years ago when he wasn't running for president. So I don't know, Joe. This is an area where I'm sorry I can't be as knowledgeable as I was about John Maynard Keynes.
Well, that's fine. But I guess my confusion is, you know, for someone that says, I don't know where my money's invested, it's in a blind trust. But then on the other hand, they pretty much closed some of his offshore accounts. So how could he not know?
He's in a position, like I said, he's in a position where he doesn't legally have to have blind trust. So certainly if people find out that he's got money in the Caymans, he can say to the trustees, close those and still call them blind. But this is a story that if he's the nominee is going to play out in much larger form, and we will find out then. Thanks a lot for the call, Joe. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Paul in Chicago. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, Paul Garrison, you had done a book signing at Google News Books a while back. So
oh, great. Yeah.
Hopefully you remember me. But I had a question regarding the gentleman that you just spoke with about amending the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't pretend to be nearly as knowledgeable as you are about these things, which is why I wanted to ask you what you think of the fact that the Supreme Court and other factions of government are basically doing an end run around the Constitution as it is these days, and therefore they don't need to amend the Constitution for their own needs to turn it into, as you said, you know, something akin to Mussolini's Italy. They simply ignore the Constitution in many ways.
Well, I agree with you, and I think that the Supreme Court has wildly exceeded the boundaries of its power. It's one of the areas where I agree with Phyllis Schlafly and Newt Gingrich, of all people. Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution explicitly says that the Supreme Court shall operate under regulations defined by Congress. Congress, by the way, is getting set right now, or at least in the Senate they did. I doubt the House will because we'll see if this becomes a partisan issue or not, to regulate the Supreme Court. And as much as they're saying that the Supreme Court, even though you don't want to have cameras during your sessions, you're going to have cameras, and we want to see and hear what's going on inside the Supreme Court. So We'll see. But, Paul, I'm with you, and that's why I think that we need to amend the Constitution right now over the short term to say corporations aren't people and money isn't speech. And over the long term, we need to overturn the concepts of judicial review and judicial supremacy. But that's a whole separate argument, a much larger one. Paul, thank you. In fact, I got to write a book on that topic once I finish the one I'm doing right now. Brenda in Baltimore. Hey, Brenda, what's up?
Hi. I want to talk about Social Security buying power going down. The Social Security checks buy less. And I also, the Medicare that they deduct keeps going up. They'll say that Medicare went up X percent and Social Security won't go up at all because there's no inflation. That's not really true.
Right. No, it's not.
And I have less money to spend. I have a $537 check.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Brenda, thank you for the call and thanks for pointing this out. Here's the deal, and Bernie Sanders talks about this all the time, and that is that the basket of goods that they look at to determine the cost of living adjustment for Social Security includes electronic goods. And so if this year the computers got twice as powerful and dropped 10% in price, and they do every year, then they say, oh, look at that, some things are getting cheaper, even though pharmaceuticals are going up, and even though milk is getting more expensive, or food, your new iPhone, it's a whole lot cheaper and more powerful. And that should not be part of the cost of living adjustments of Social Security. Jeff in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
I was just wondering why nobody, on the course of everybody talking about raising the tax on billionaires and the corporations, where they've never give them a loophole to get out of it. Okay, say they raise taxes on corporation billionaires, but allow them to offset that by hiring people in the United States, offset every dollar for every person they hire.
Well, they can do that right now. If you hire somebody, that is a tax-deductible expense. I run a small business, which is this show, and before we calculate our taxes at the end of the year, or if we showed a profit, you take out all your payroll. And so right now, if these millionaires and billionaires actually wanted to be job creators, and there was any truth to the idea that people who have millions and billions of dollars are job creators, then, they could start hiring people, and they could do like Keynes did. They could hire people, or, he suggested in his ad absurdium example, they could hire one guy to dig a hole and hire another guy to fill it, put some money in people's pockets so they'd start stimulating the economy. They'd go out in there and buy goods. But I don't think any of these so-called job creators are really interested in creating jobs. What they're interested in doing is putting money in their accounts in the Cayman Islands where they can churn it in their 401k and not pay income tax on it. Jeff, thanks for the call. You just did an incredibly elegant job of totally punching a hole in this argument that Grover Norquist is trying to put forward, that these guys are job creators.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Lamar Smith, the Republican from Texas, has been sitting in his seat for several decades now, doing just fine, thank you very much. And then he authors this Stop Online Piracy Act. By the way, the international version of this, ACTA, there literally were riots in the streets in Europe over the weekend about six more nations have to sign it, and we get an international version of it. Six more nations. And so people in Europe are saying, no, we stopped it here, but Lamar Smith was pushing this thing pretty aggressively, and apparently one of the authors of it, and which brought him into the, crosshairs of former Sheriff Richard Mack, who is now running for Congress against Congressman Smith in the 21st District of Texas. Sheriff Mack, a member of the Oath Keepers, his website sheriffmack.com, his book The Magic of Gun Control, The Magic. Richard Mack, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. I sure appreciate being with you.
Thanks for joining us. The Stop Online Piracy Act, This whole idea of shutting down the internet, and I see you're having a battle right now. I'm looking at your website with PayPal, and whatnot. You know, this idea of government controlling the internet beyond, you know, the basic, you know, we want government to offer us basic protections, right? We want like a military to keep our borders safe. And it seems like on the internet, you would want some sort of a structure saying, okay, we're not going to let one company take over the internet any more than we're going to let one person or one nation. But,
right.
But SOPA was such an overreach, you know, and I'm speaking from the left. Your thoughts from the right?
Well, I don't know if it's left or right, but I know having the federal government take over is wrong. And Congressman Smith has continuously supported Big Brother government in Washington, D.C., and that's all this is. This is more Big Brother government looking over our shoulder. And, of course, it's Congressman Smith going against the businesses that need his protection in Washington, D.C., and instead he's attacking them. Rackspace is a huge internet company in San Antonio. And I went there and toured the facility, and all of their CEOs there and vice presidents have been speaking out against this. And this is Congressman Smith siding with big donors from Hollywood and special interests from Hollywood instead of taking care of the people that are in his own district.
Yeah, well, I would submit to you it's not even Hollywood because Sony, for example, owns most of the properties that you know, or so many. If you go to economyandcrisis.org or .com, I forget which it is, they have a list, and something like 80-90% of all of our motion picture industry now is actually owned by foreign corporations. So
that's sad but true. But so is our own government because we continue.
Yep.
Another thing that Congressman Smith is in favor of, and that is continue to borrow money from Red China so that we can pay out more foreign aid to countries who don't even support us at the UN. And I've never heard of anything more asinine in my life. We literally are borrowing money from Red China so that we can pay other countries like Egypt and Greece and El Salvador and other third world countries who vote against us 70% of the time in the UN. We don't have the money. And that's one thing that Congressman Smith does not get. He continues to side with the liberals in increasing the debt limit. He sides with Barack Obama in the NDAA. He sides with him in increasing the debt ceiling. And this is how stupid this government is. This is, if we don't spend more money that we don't have to pay off other debt that we didn't have the money to spend on that one, then our credit rating will go down.
Yeah.
I've never heard of anything more asinine in my life.
Well, our credit rating has gone down, and it hasn't affected our ability to sell T-bills, and I'm no defender of government debt. I was horrified when Ronald Reagan, in 8 years, ran up more debt than every president from George Washington to Jimmy Carter combined. I was horrified.
Now we have a president that has done it with the complicity of Congress. Congress holds the purse strings. Let's be real here. Congress holds the purse strings.
And the House of Representatives is controlled by Lamar Smith and his Republican buddies right now.
Exactly.
So I think that one of the things that Sheriff Mack, Richard Mack, maybe we can agree on is that, I mean, you might want to demonize liberals for this. It wasn't liberals who ran up this debt. It was Reagan, Bush, and Bush. Bill Clinton gave us the only balanced budget we've seen since the Carter administration. And
yeah, they make that claim, but I went to the United States Supreme Court.
Well, it was close.
It was a balance at that time, and I won a case at the United States Supreme Court against the Clinton administration. I don't buy that they ever balanced it, but maybe on some paperwork they did. However, you just said Reagan ran up the biggest debt. You might be right, but now the biggest debt in American history is happening right now. Obama has the notion that we can spend our way out of a recession, spend our way out of debt. I don't care what you have to do. You can't spend money you don't have.
Really?
And now that they spend all this money in corrupt ways, and I will tell you
so
right
you
now.
So you have never bought a house on a mortgage, sir?
Certainly I have.
Wait a minute. You spent money you didn't have?
Of course.
And I'll bet you did that. I'll bet you spent that money you didn't have to buy that house so that you could have a better quality of life.
Okay, but you're the one that said that Reagan raised up all this debt, and now you want to ignore that Obama's done it even.
No, I don't. As you point out, Congress has the purse strings. Obama's proposing.
Along that line of borrowing money, I mean, you bring up mortgages. I would still say that a mortgage and maybe a car are the only places you should do that. But
I would say that when you're in a recession is the only time a country should do it. Or in a war.
No, come on. Well, first of all, then we could talk about all these wars that we've gone through that we've shouldn't have been in the first place and spending money that we didn't
have. Well, we'll probably find a hell of a lot of agreement there, Sheriff. But the fact of the matter is that in 1946, 1947, when we came out of World War II, between the money that Franklin Roosevelt had borrowed to initially get us out of the Depression and the money, and far more massively, orders of magnitude more massively, the money that we borrowed to spend to fight World War II, our debt, the United States debt, was 127% of GDP. And right now it's not even at 100% of GDP, but it's damn close. And we paid that debt off over the next 10 years. And how did we do it? We did it by Harry Truman and the Republican Dwight Eisenhower using borrowed money to build the national highway system, to build public schools, to build hospitals, to jumpstart the economy of this nation and put us back on our feet.
Well, you can argue that both ways. I mean, FDR in his New Deal was another big push towards socialism, and there's many reports that say that if he would have just simply stayed out of the way, that the recession or the depression would have solved itself much quicker.
That worked really well for Herbert Hoover for 3 years, didn't it?
I don't know, but FDR.
Well, no, it didn't.
Plan could very well.
We're about out of time, but get back with me on this. If you can find one country in the history of the world that has ever cut its way to prosperity, I'd love to know the name of it.
Well, I didn't say cut. What I'm saying is there's other responsible ways to run the economy than just spend, spend, and spend.
Okay, I'll agree with you on that. We'll leave it on that point. People can check out your website at sheriffmack.com. Richard Mack running against
Congress.
Say that again?
Mack for Congress. Sheriff Mack for Congress.
Sheriff Mack for Congress. I'm sorry. Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Stick around. Welcome back to your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program. And Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Carl, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing today?
Great. What's up?
Well, I'm doing fine as well. You know, what universe do Republicans live in? It can't be fact-based, whatever it is.
They live in the Foxiverse.
Absolutely, the Foxiverse. I think you've just coined something, the Foxiverse. They're in the bubble.
Yeah.
You can have your own opinion, that's fine, but you can't have your own facts. Facts are Ronald Reagan raised taxes around 12 times. He raised the debt ceiling numerous of times. And now all of a sudden I've noticed that my Republican friends, they're against the war in Iraq and Iran. And you know for a fact, had anyone spoke out 5, 6, 7 years ago against any of those wars, we were unpatriotic communists.
Yep.
And now they're against war that wasn't on the books. Now they're against Medicare Part D that ballooned the debt and the deficit. It's amazing that these people are all of a sudden they're physically conservative all of a sudden. But when Bush was there, nothing. Yep. And it's amazing how they run around and they want to do away with women's abortion rights and those type of things when they had the courts, the Senate, the House, and the presidency for 6 years. But they did nothing, but they dragged this dead dog out every 4, 6, 8 years and beat it and throw it out there for people to look at. And I'm like, wait a minute, when you had all the power, you did nothing about it.
Yeah, and the biggest dead dog is the debt. I mean, you know, the Republicans and there's actually, Carl, thank you for the call. Let me just go off on this for a moment, if I may. There's actually a strategy here. And that strategy was laid out back in the 1970s by a guy by the name of Jude Winiski. And Jude Winiski was a Republican. He was kind of a hanger-oner here in Washington, D.C., and a strategist around the fringes. But he had this one brilliant idea. And, in fact, the guy who was the head of the Heritage Foundation, I'm forgetting his name now, he's somebody you've never heard of it anyway, wrote an op-ed piece in which he said, when Jude Winiski came up with his two Santa Claus theory, Newt Gingrich thought he had died and gone to heaven. Now, this was back in the late 70s. And what Winiski said, here's what we've got to do. He said, Republicans have, you know, ever since Republicans tried to stop Social Security in 1935, and they've been trying to privatize it right up until the 70s, and you know, they fought Medicare, and they fought this, and they fought that. And he said, Republicans are always seen as the bad guys. They're seen as the Ebenezer Scrooges. And he said, and the Democrats have always been seen, at least since the Roosevelt administration, as the Santa Clauses. The Democrats brought us the 40-hour work week. The Republicans fought against it. The Democrats brought us minimum wage laws. The Republicans fought against it. You know, Santa Claus screws. Santa Claus Scrooge. The Democrats brought us Social Security. Republicans fought against us. Santa Claus Scrooge. The Democrats brought us, clean water laws. Republicans fought against it. The Democrats brought us clean air laws. The Republicans fought against it. The Democrats brought us the EPA. Republicans fought against us. And on, you know, the list goes on and on. Right. Workplace safety rules, child labor laws, women's rights, on and on it goes. So he said, you know, the problem is that the Republicans are always viewed as Scrooge and the Democrats are always viewed as Santa Claus. So we've got to figure out a way that the Republicans can be viewed as Santa Claus and that the Democrats can be put in such a corner that they will be forced to, and this was Winiski's phrase, shoot Santa Claus. In other words, shoot the Santa Claus that they themselves had created. Republican, he came up with a strategy where Republicans could force Democrats to shoot Santa Claus by cutting back on Social Security and Medicare. By not raising the minimum wage, by cutting back on wages for working people. And he said the way you do this is really simple. He said, first of all, turn Republicans into Santa Clauses of tax cuts. And turn them into the Santa Clauses of spending. So when a Republican comes to office and the Republicans control the show, and keep in mind this was in the 70s, just before Reagan was elected, when Republicans control the show, run up as much debt as you can, as fast as you can, and by spending as much money as you can, and by cutting taxes as much as you can on pretty much everybody, but particularly the rich people, so everybody perceives you as Santa Claus. And then when the Democrats come into office, start screaming about the debt. And so that the Democrats won't be able to do anything except pay down the debt that the Republicans ran up, which means there won't be any money left to pay off to, you know, for Social Security and Medicare and unemployment benefits and all these other Santa Clauses that the Democrats have created. So the Democrats are going to have to shoot the Santa Claus of unemployment benefits. And they're going to have to shoot the Santa Claus of Social Security, which all of which they created themselves. And Winiski said, if you keep to this principle, this simple two Santa Claus principle, become the Santa Clauses of tax cuts and become the Santa Claus of spending like crazy. And then whenever the Democrats are in office, stop being that Santa Claus and start screaming about the debt. As long as Republicans hold to this principle, eventually the day will come when the debt is so big that even the Democrats will agree that they got to shoot Santa Claus. And then you make the Democrats do it on their watch because Republicans clearly aren't going to do it. As our last caller just said, you know, they had control of the House, they had control of the Senate, they had control of the White House on and off over, you know, all these. Did they do away with Social Security? No. Did they, you know, do away with workplace safety rules? No. Did they loosen the regulations on COVID? No, not so much. Yeah, because they were busy spending money and cutting taxes, being Santa Claus. So now the Republicans have found out where that threshold is where the Democrats have to shoot Santa Claus. It seems to be around, you know, $11, $12, $13 trillion debt. Almost all of which was run up by Republicans. Jude Waninski is dead now. He died some about a decade ago, but he's got to be smiling from the grave as the Democrats are fixing to shoot Santa Claus, unless Obama's budget comes through.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
My apologies to all our callers on hold for a long rant there, but I thought it was... It's important that you know this stuff. You know, I'll pick up your calls right now. 27 minutes past. That's the good, the bad, and the very, very immarcescibly ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good. New Mexico State Legislature. Both the New Mexico State House and Senate passed a memorial on Friday condemning the Citizens United court decision, calling for a constitutional amendment to fix it. While a memorial lacks the force of law, it is still a very strong show of sentiments and beliefs. One of the sponsors of the bill, State Senator Steve Fishman, said, voters need to know their opinions count as much as any corporate entity, trade, or labor association. I'm proud the New Mexico State Senate is willing to stand up for this principle. New Mexico now joins Hawaii as the second state to officially condemn Citizens United. New Mexico clearly understands the damage Citizens United has done to our political process and society. Hopefully, more states decide to get on board and help shut it down. The bad. Wall Street fat cats. While bonuses and profits are reportedly dwindling on Wall Street, a new report released by the Center for Responsive Politics shows that the financial services industry is on track to shatter previous records for political spending. The report also states that the industry's spending is in hopes of defeating President Obama and putting in office a candidate who opposes the Dodd-Frank financial regulations enacted in 2008. Mitt Romney has already received $12.4 million from financial services companies, with that number expected to grow much larger come November. It's quite clear that Wall Street wants to get back to the Bush days when it was unregulated, anything goes, Wild West type of industry. Corporate greed is rearing its ugly head yet again. And the very, very ugly Senator Roy Blunt. In response to President Obama's controversial birth control mandate, Blunt is expected to offer an amendment to the Affordable Health Care Act that would basically permit any employer or insurance plan to exclude from health care, no matter how essential or critical it may be, if they have moral objections to it. Under the plan, some types of health services that could not be covered include AIDS screening, type 2 diabetes treatments, cancer tests, and basically anything else that is deemed the result of an immoral lifestyle. Cancer and diabetes are two of the most prevalent diseases in America today and affect millions of Americans every year. Senator Blunt is letting his personal and religious beliefs cloud his judgment and is engaging in a very dangerous game of pick and choose, which would put the lives of millions of Americans at risk. And that is very, very ugly. Amazing. What an amazing time we live in. You know, it's absolutely incredible. And Rick Santorum beating Mitt Romney in Michigan. It's just incredible. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Mike in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. I watch your show religiously on Free Speech TV, and I think I own most of your books as well. You know, you talk a lot about Reagan ending free education in California because the students might become educated and vote against them. And I think the media right now is keeping the voting electorate and the citizens in this country uneducated by not calling out these Republican candidates and their surrogates when they appear on these TV and radio shows. And I just finished reading Bill Press's book, and I worked in radio and television news for a number of years, and it is just furious. And I've heard you talk about this before, you know, yeah. The surrogates, you know, not being called out. And I, you know, I find myself just screaming at the television sometimes about they're getting away with all these talking points. And, you know, I watched your interview, you know, last hour with the sheriff, and once they're called out on some of their ideology, they just fold. They don't have anything there except their ideology and rhetoric.
Yeah.
And how this, you know, I wanted your comment or your opinion, how you think it's going to affect, you know, future elections when you have an uneducated electorate. Now,
I think you're not
asking the tough questions that should be asked to these, and let them get by with, you know, both parties get by with the rhetoric.
Yep. No, I'm totally with you, and I thank you for the call, Mike. Well said. I think this is one of the great crises of America right now, is that we have reporters who are actually media stars, and multimillion dollar a year media stars, by the way, and they know that their personal multimillion dollar salaries and the future of their television programs depends on having continuous access to particular high-profile politicians, particularly on the right. And they also know that if they start calling those people out, those people won't show up on their shows. And so they don't call them out. They let them get away with this kind of stuff. And on the right and the left, for that matter. But mostly on the right. And, in fact, it makes me even crazy. I mean, I just watched you Meet the Press on Sunday, and David Gregory was actually quoting right-wing talking points when he was talking to people. I mean, of course, I think he is probably a Republican and you know, certainly is a multimillionaire. And so this is the result. And, you know, back in Walter Cronkite's day, he wasn't that. I mean, news people back before Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act and we saw this massive consolidation of media in the United States. And then Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act, and you saw the airwaves getting sold off, and another wave of consolidation. You know, and back before 87, when Reagan stopped enforcing the Fairness Doctrine, used to be that news actually had to be news, and radio and television stations, in order to maintain their license, had to actually serve the public good by having real news. And now it's infotainment or propaganda, or in some cases, outright propaganda. And it's not a good thing for this country. And until we start enforcing the Sherman Act again, and until we start taking serious the need to have an educated electorate, which Thomas Jefferson spoke about so eloquently, we're going to have a democracy at risk. I absolutely think. And so, anyhow, Alex in Santa Cruz. Hey, Alex, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Mike was a good segue to what I want to say. I haven't heard you say anything about Clint Eastwood's Halftime in America commercial. I don't know if I missed it or.
Yeah, we played it the day after and on Monday and Monday was the, and then I was sick Tuesday and Wednesday. But we played it on Monday and I, or if we didn't, I certainly intended to. I'm pretty sure we did, and I saluted him. I think Clint Eastwood is spectacular.
Well, it had a lot of potential. It seemed like it really was appealing or feeding into everyone's emotional fears of the deindustrialization of America that everyone is walking around thinking consciously or unconsciously about as a result of. And the problem is that since that aired, he's been defending himself as not supporting Obama.
Right.
And then I think it was yesterday or the day before I saw on the Huffington Post where he was being interviewed and saying that America should not be spending. We should be cutting. He said, quote, you know, you can't, the age-old rule, you can't spend money you don't have that has been passed on from father to son.
Right. Apparently Clint Eastwood has never bought a house on a mortgage either.
Well, yeah, that was a good point you made before. But my understanding is that what saved Chrysler was a $12.5 billion loan that the federal government borrowed to save Chrysler. And so on the one hand, he's promoting Chrysler as an example of how America is pulling itself up from its own bootstraps and bringing us forward. But in the same time, I think that this is just terrible for the average Joe, you know, in middle America who doesn't understand the lapse of the disconnect between those two. So in other words,
I got it, Alex. And you're I got it. And you're absolutely right. And let me, you know, for the record, Clint Eastwood's politics have typically been Republican or conservative throughout his life. I thought he was a brilliant actor and, you know, watched him since he was Rowdy Yates in Rawhide and, you know, love his work as an actor. I think he's a genius. I don't think he's a genius as a politician and or as an economist. But that ad was not so much Clint Eastwood as it was paid for by the car companies. And they were basically, you know, hey, we're back. You know, it was an ad for the car companies. And I don't think it was a pro or anti-Obama ad. It was a, hey, here's where we're at, and I think they did a good job of saying it. Alex, I got to move along, but, you know, good point. Thank you very much. Mike in Albuquerque. Mike, we got a minute to the break. What's up?
Yeah, first I want to commend you because you're the only left-winger that I've really connected with. I'm a small business guy, slightly right of center. But anytime I hear about socialism or big anything, because I'm a small business guy, to me, it smacks of poor productivity because you just can't fire people that easily. You know, and I know that in small business, if you have somebody that's not producing, you help them along as much as you can, and then you move them along. And
well, you do in big business, too.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, I've worked for big businesses, Tom. You probably have, too, and it doesn't work that easy. I mean, you get stuck working with these duds that are there for years.
Yeah. If that's the case, then you've got a poorly run business. I mean, it's even unions will not generally defend workers who are not productive. You know,
not these days, but they used to.
Well,
big government does it all the time. I mean, yeah. These poor state workers. You know, if you have 100 of them, 50 to 75 are great, and you're going to have 10 to 15 that just are going to drag everybody down, and you can't hardly get rid of them.
Mike, I you know, the numbers you're talking about, you're going to see in any kind of organization, you're going to see problems. The biggest problem that state workers have right now is that they don't have time to get their jobs done because so many of their peers have been fired. We've had 500,000 layoffs.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Actually, it's now up to 700,000 since Obama became president. 700,000 government employees, mostly in red states. Most of the Republican governors have been laid off.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Our Talk Radio News Report brought to you by Ellen Ratner's new book, Self-Empowerment. Her and Anne Gaiman wrote it, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st. That's quite a leap. Victoria, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So what's going on today?
Well, President Obama's budget came out today.
Mm-hmm.
He unveiled a $3.8 trillion spending plan, and the idea is to put a lot of money into the economy and also raise taxes on the rich. The plan is to sort of try to tame the national debt. Now, the thing is that they do anticipate that his proposals are going to hold annual deficits well under $600 billion after next year. Nevertheless, we do have a $1.33 trillion deficit this year. It will go down to $901 billion next year. There's an awful lot in this budget, but some of the more interesting things, he plans to replace the alternative minimum tax with the Buffett rule.
Interesting. If I may just interrupt you very quickly. So he's got a $3.8 trillion spending plan, and you said it's going to be $600 billion in the red?
It will hold annual deficits under $600 billion after next year.
Okay, so it's $3.8 trillion in spending and $3.2 trillion in revenues. Do you know what and apparently our revenues right now must be in the neighborhood of 2.8 or something like that?
I think something like that.
Yeah, okay. All right. Just trying to get this clear.
Keep going. No, it gets
the buffer rule.
It gets really in the weeds.
So he replaces the alternative minimum tax with the buffer rule, but he's only applying that to people who earn over $1 million a year, or is he hitting, because the AMT was originally designed for people who would, in today's dollars, have an income of over roughly $250,000.
Right, but he also lets the Bush tax cuts from 2001 and 2003 expire on households making more than $250,000 a year. and on individuals making more than $200,000 a year. Those making less than that, those tax cuts continue. So he gets revenue from that.
So this is a very, actually, that's a fairly elegant way to get around the problem of the AMT not being indexed for inflation over all these years.
Yeah, so he does that. He also goes, he targets hedge fund managers and private equity partners who currently pay a 15% capital gains rate carried on, which is known as carried interest, which I'm sure you've talked about.
Yeah, this is how Mitt Romney makes his money and how he why he only pays a little less than 15% in income taxes. Federal income taxes.
Right, exactly. And so he gets rid of that, and he plans to tax those profits at ordinary income rates, raising $13 billion over 10 years.
So he's going to do the exact same thing Ronald Reagan did in 1986. Paul, do you still have that Reagan clip? That is so priceless. I have to play this for you, Victoria. You're going to love this. This is Ronald Reagan in 86 when he asked that the capital gains rate be lifted up to 28%, and he got it what he wanted for 1 year, so that the millionaires, so that the capital gains loophole was done away with, and the millionaires would pay the same amount as bus drivers. Here it is.
We're going to close the unproductive tax loopholes that have allowed some of the truly wealthy to avoid paying their fair share. They sometimes made it possible for millionaires to pay nothing, while a bus driver was paying 10% of his salary, and that's crazy.
And that's crazy.
Wow.
Yeah. So President Obama is channeling his inner Reagan.
I don't think he could have said that at CPAC.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think so. Excuse me.
I'm sorry, I made you cough.
Yeah, that's okay. It happens whenever I laugh.
He doesn't touch Social Security, and actually he doesn't really go after federal programs like Medicare very much. He goes about $360 billion over the next decade, mostly by reducing payments to drug companies and other providers. Then starting in 2017, he proposes to raise premiums for new retirees and seniors with higher incomes and begin charging co-payments for home health services. So, obviously, House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan has gone after this in a very serious way, because he plans in the House budget, which they do plan to introduce a House budget, a major overhaul of Medicare. Now, whether he plans his overhaul of Medicare, which was a straight voucher system, or whether he plans his overhaul of Medicare, which he's introducing with Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat, we don't know whether he's planning to do that or not.
Oh, he's going to do the one with Wyden, because they found one Democrat who was dumbass enough to go along with something with Paul Ryan, and now all of the Republicans are, and I got, you know, generally a lot of respect for Ron Wyden, but he must have been high that day. I cannot come up with any other explanation, either that or they're holding his daughter ransom. I mean, it's got to be something. Anyhow.
He's going to be the single most unpopular Democrat on Capitol Hill. There's no question about that.
And the Republicans are just going to hammer this thing. They're going to hammer it. It's bipartisan. You got Ron Wyden behind it. Look at that. He's a liberal. He's Morgan. He's, you know, and they might play some clips when I was nice to him on the radio. I mean, who knows? Anyway, back to you.
Well, the sequester, which, as you know, the super committee failed. They were supposed to come up with $1.2 trillion in cuts, or let's put it this way, in deficit reduction. Not necessarily cuts, but deficit reduction, which they failed to do. President Obama does not include that in his budget because he assumes that somehow Congress will be able to come up with savings. And so, that this is something that, you know, he and they will be able to do this.
So is this high stakes chicken or is this magical numbers?
I think it's a combination. I do think there's a little bit of magic in here, and this budget's never going to see daylight.
Yeah. Well, of course.
This is a campaign document.
Of course. All budgets start in the House. The Constitution requires it. The House is run by Republican crazies right now, so. Okay, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. And we'll be back. We're not going to be back. It's the end of the show. Hey, coming up tomorrow, U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown. Are we heading in the right direction? And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.